Thank you, Shreyas, for joining me on the podcast today and taking the time. I really appreciate it. You have worked as a product manager at Stripe and Twitter, Google, and Yahoo before that, after starting your career as an engineer. You're also a startup advisor to several companies and angel invested in many more over the last decade or so. And you're also now teaching a course through which you've coached over, I think, 2,000 product managers after doing a lot of one-on-one coaching before that. I was listening to a podcast you did with Shane Parrish recently, and you defined your definition of success as basically having optionality with your time, and asking yourself the question of, are you able to spend your time in the ways that sort of align most with your priorities at that given time? And so I'm curious. I think an interesting way to start the podcast today would be to talk about how you've spent your time in 2023, and how you might like to spend it in 2024, if there's any differences in how you're spending it versus the past, and ideas for the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me. In terms of my time, I am now in the next chapter of my career. So the first chapter was really about working as an engineer and a product manager, product leader at various companies, building products mainly, and trying to make them successful. And then in 2021, I decided to embark on this next chapter of my career, which is not about operational role, and it's more about kind of almost synthesizing a lot of what I've learned over the years, and then helping others with it. And so that has taken the form of, let's say, if we take 2023, and I look back on sort of just mainly the work front, I've spent 20 percent of my time advising startup founders. It's usually growth stage startups. I've spent 60% of my time this year teaching, and about 10% writing, and about 10% on business operations, because I now run a very small business, and there's a lot of operational tasks that need to get done, and I tend to deprioritize them as much as possible. But they kind of need to get done, so I end up spending about 10% of my time on that. And overall, I still work at a fairly fast pace, and usually work all 7 days of the week. But that said, I have a lot of schedule flexibility. And I think that has been just an amazing experience to have that flexibility with my schedule. So, for instance, I can travel when I want to, although I actually don't travel all that much. And I can spend time with my teenager whenever he's in the mood for that. I do a lot of pickup drop-offs and handle most of the logistics for him. With him and get to spend just a lot of time with him. And that's been a great gift as well. Looking forward to 2024, I expect it to be largely more of the same. So roughly the same type of time allocation, really. But there are perhaps a couple of differences I'll call out. So on the work front, I'll be offering a couple of new courses in 2024, including a course on Product Sense and how to make better and more correct product decisions, and perhaps even one on communication and influence and some other possible courses. On the advising front, some of my formal advising is ending in 2023, so I'll be taking on a couple more advisory roles in the next year. But one other important thing I want to call out is that I'll be spending a lot more time in 2024 on my health. And so, as you're aware, we had to postpone the recording of this podcast a couple of times, mainly because I had doctor appointments and other things. So, I've had not major health issues, but at least a couple of kind of health reminders over the past couple of months, which have really made me realize that I gotta focus more on my health. And it isn't that I wasn't really health focused. But it's more of gotta do even more of it. And so I do expect looking at 2024, I'll be spending more time on health and nutrition.
Great. Yeah, I know from my own experience, I've had like sort of some chronic back and like sort of neck pain. And for me, it was like this catalyst to, continue to try to do better and better on a health front, where several years ago, coming out of college, I had never really prioritized my health. And then I sort of took it one lever at a time, starting with, my nutrition and doing some intermittent fasting and things like that, and then getting into running, and then more recently, weightlifting. And it's just sort of been like stacking one thing on top of the other, and it still hasn't really solved the original, driver, which was like the back and the neck thing. But it's like you said, I think it's not like a huge thing that prohibits me from doing what I want to do, but it's just kind of like this driving force. I'm curious, is there any sort of levers that you have in mind for 2024 that you want to pull on to try to sort of increase the prioritization of health, or still figuring that out?
Well, so it turns out I also have been suffering from some back pain, lower back pain. And in my 20s, it was mostly like minor pain that I started feeling just before I got up in the morning. And then it would just, take care of itself, go away within 10, 20 minutes of waking up. And so, I asked doctors what to do, and their standard advice was like, "Oh, change your mattress." And it's like, "No, I already have a pretty good mattress." And many of them weren't quite sure. They would just say, "Oh, yeah, go to physical therapy or something like that." A couple of years ago, it's actually almost exactly 2 years ago, December of 2021, when I got a very scary back spasm, and basically was debilitating. I told my wife that as a male, this is the most pain I have ever experienced. It was just excruciating, and I couldn't move, couldn't do anything for almost a week. I had a couple of talks that I had to then postpone. Unfortunately, and even though sort of more than 1,000 people had signed up for those talks, like just had to postpone because I couldn't sit. I just started playing tennis, or I picked up tennis again around that time. And so I thought, oh, it's the tennis. And when I do play tennis, I'm like, I go pretty hard. So I stopped playing tennis and went to the doctor. And it was the same recommendations as before, like, oh, go to physical therapy and et cetera, rest your back, blah, blah, blah. And so I tried all that. I was like properly doing a PT for a while. And then the back spasm happened again in 3 months afterwards. And again, I was just completely, just couldn't do anything whatsoever. So at that point, you start like, first of all, you're really scared, like, which is like, what's wrong with this core part of my body? And second, will my life ever be the same again? So I was kind of going through those thoughts. And luckily at the time, I speak with Jim O'Shaughnessy every once in a while. And I know he's been on the podcast. And I was talking to Jim. And Jim asked me, when I told him about the back issues, he said, "Well, have you heard of Dr. Sarno's work?" And then I wasn't aware of his work. And after that, I read his book, Healing Back Pain. And as I was going through that book in March, as I'm suffering from this back spasm and just completely immobile, he lays out some criteria for, people who suffer back pain where there's actually nothing physically wrong with their body. And it turns out that the pain is real, but it's actually initiated by your mind. And it happens to highly conscientious people who are very ambitious and who have a very high degree of emotional regulation. And so he had a bunch of criteria in the book of like, it typically tends to happen to, folks who exhibit these kinds of traits. And I'm going, check, 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 check. It's like you are literally describing me. And so that's when I realized that, oh, perhaps there is some value in this. And since then, I've realized that like my back pain is actually not a result of anything that's really wrong with my back, but rather it is TMS, tension myoneural syndrome. And the wonderful part about all of this is like that the knowledge and recognition is the cure. And the first thing they say is stop doing physical therapy, stop going to PT. So again, this is not medical advice, but I'm just sharing my experience I realized that basically a lot of my back issues are mainly a result of repressed emotions, feelings, repressed anger, and other things in my mind, which then manifests in the body.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember I read that book as well, like maybe a couple of years ago, and it was refreshing because it takes like a very contrarian view versus most of what you would assume is sort of the issue if you have back pain. And for me, I guess I wasn't really able to apply it. I haven't noticed any like meaningful improvement since then, but it's maybe worth a reread because I do think it's very similar for me. It's certainly some people do have actual physical issues that this is not going to solve, but for people like you and I think probably myself, it's a great place to start. So highly recommend the book for those who haven't come across it yet. One more thing, and then I want to sort of dig in on this course that you've started, and sounds like you've got more in the pipeline as well. But just in regards to how you've spent your time, you gave like very kind of specific percentages. I don't know if those were estimates or if you have sort of a methodology or a process by which you kind of track your time more consciously. So curious if there's anything interesting there. And then secondarily to that, you mentioned sort of working 7 days a week, but having that total flexibility. I'm curious if this is sort of an adjustment from a previous sort of work style where, maybe when you were at Stripe or whatever, it was more of like the 5 days on, 2 days off, or 6 days on, 1 day off sort of thing. If that's like sort of a new way of living for you, to kind of treat every day the same and, insert freedom to travel and flexibility to work out or pick up your kids where you want to, or if you've always been like sort of a 7 days a week guy.
Definitely not a 7 days a week guy in the previous chapter of my career. Definitely worked very hard. Sometimes had to do very long hours. But at the same time, I was mostly able to be very productive, certainly, especially in the last decade of my chapter one. I was able to be a lot more productive effective without doing absolutely crazy hours, even when I was kind of leading fast-growing businesses and teams. So have done my share of weekend work in the past, but what I'm doing now is very new to me, and it really stems from not even a decision to do it. It really occurs because of natural desire to do it, and particularly because, again, I run my own very small business. The way it really manifests is just this idea of like, well, I'm excited to do this work today, whatever that might be. And plus, there is also the if I do it, I will very clearly see XYZ benefit of doing it, whether it's additional revenue or some kind of additional help or impact on others. So being able to see that very clearly, and usually for the kind of work I do, the feedback loop is actually fairly tight. And so I think those are factors that kind of drive this tendency to work all 7 days a week now in this new chapter of my career, more so than kind of the rational factors or some intentional decision that I'm going to do this. So I really think it kind of goes back to when you there is deep interest and just overall innate passion for something, you just end up doing it because discipline is good and one must use discipline on a regular basis. But you can't just get by on discipline because There's only a finite amount of it, and you'll tend to run out of it. As I used to run out of discipline back in the first chapter of my career, where yeah, sure, I'll do weekends, at times, but then at some point, I kind of did not have the energy and the discipline to just continue doing that, all 52 weeks of the year.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of parallels between us. I just recently, coincidentally, I have a whiteboard in my office where I put, Monday through Friday every week, and I kind of put like the big things that I want to get done on those days and sort of like prioritize that way, just so it's like in my face throughout the week. And literally, like 2 days ago, I think it was, I added Saturday and Sunday because I just started to realize, like, you know what, Saturday and Sunday, I don't need to treat them exactly the same as like a Monday, but there's no reason to like not have priorities on those days. And just trying to view it more as a 7 day week, because similar to you, like have my fair share of, weekend work in the past, but like I came from an investment banking background. And so like Monday through Friday, you might work like, or Monday through Thursday, at least you might work like 10 to 10 or whatever. And then you really need that weekend to kind of, unplug, and you have some work, but it's not nearly the same as like a Monday or a Tuesday. And now that I'm sort of more in control of my time, like you are, it's like, well, I have this work that I kind of want to do. Like, there's no reason to restrict myself to Monday to Friday. I can spread it out over the course of the week. And if a Wednesday seems like the best day to take off that week, I can do that. And just, I think it's all aligned with the general trend since the world kind of went remote through COVID, that people can, for some people, I think, they like to just have the routine of going into an office and maybe having, being told what to do a little bit more. But for those who really enjoy and appreciate the autonomy over their time and the ability to manage their own time, it's like the greatest gift ever to A, be able to work remote, and then B, if you do have the flexibility to sort of like do your own thing, to just decide, how and when and where you want to do that. So moving on, I know you mentioned the course earlier, and I want to talk more about that. I understand you had actually like been thinking about teaching ever since you were a kid. And obviously, like, sort of didn't act on that immediately in a huge way in terms of your career, but I think you did TA for a little while, and that sort of confirmed your interest in teaching. You really enjoyed that. So what finally like triggered you to go and actually build this course? I think you were doing it on Maven, and it's basically targeting product managers, not people who want to become them, but people who already are them, and how to sort of level up in their career and things like that. It's actually more focused on sort of career improvement than improvement as a PM in particular. So I'm curious sort of how you decided to actually start that, how you decided on, the subject matter for the course. And ultimately, I believe it's the number one course on the platform on Maven. So huge success so far. And curious some of the elements you sort of brought into to building that.
In 2021, I decided I'll go down the unconventional path, and kind of start this next chapter of my career. I mainly started with advising, and by that time, mainly because of COVID, I had also started writing in 2020, and so I was spending my time advising and writing. And as I did that for about a year, I realized that there was a piece missing in my, let's just say, overall approach and strategy. And so the realization was that my advising was very deep, but with very few people. Just by definition, it's only going to be with a few founders and a few companies. But it was very deep and very high impact for that individual company, right? So that was one end of that kind of spectrum. The other end of it was the writing, whose impact, probably is not as deep for every individual who gets exposed to the writing. But over time, it became incredibly broad, with like hundreds of thousands of people kind of following my writing. And so the observation was that, like, okay, so I've got these two covered, but there's something missing in between, where I asked myself, what is a way for me to create more impact than my writing, but to do so with more people than the number of founders I can possibly advise? And so that's when I realized that, okay, the answer to this will be to teach. And the approach I took very early on as I was thinking through it is, well, how will my teaching be different? And how will I differentiate myself? And so the answer for me was that I wanted my teaching to feel like coaching, right? So while I cannot possibly coach people one-on-one anymore, I mean, I do coach some people, but it's very limited. I really wanted my teaching to feel like coaching, right? So for it to have the kind of deep impact that coaching does, but also to be able to do it at a reasonable amount of scale. And so I use that as the guiding principle in designing my course. And yeah, it's been really fun. We've run 9 cohorts of this course already. Another cohort, the next cohort is coming up in January. The current course is about managing your product career. So it is for PMs, product managers, but turns out, hundreds of engineers, designers, and other folks who work in, work with products and work on products have also found it very useful. And again, really the approach I take is, yes, it is about actually managing your career, but the section we spend the most time on, especially on the first day, is about growing and increasing your competence. So, that is the core principle, is that, the best way to manage your career over the long term is to become really great at the job. And then we talk about, it's not possible to cover every single product skill over a weekend course, but we talk about ways in which, unconventional ways in which, and structures with which, and habits with which, and frameworks with which you can intentionally grow your competence. And that's just one of like 7 or 8 core sections that we cover over the weekend. Yeah, it's been really fun. On the second part of how it ended up, how it has ended up being, successful. Here's one observation. After I started teaching and the course started getting some traction, folks have come to me, instructors, teachers of online courses, might ping me and they might ask for marketing tips, like how do you market your course? I've also seen, I'm part of some forums, of folks who kind of teach courses, I just sometimes will look through comments and questions, and most comments and questions from instructors are about, well, how do I market this thing, right? I'll tell you, I don't think there's anybody who has sort of approached me and asked me, Shreyas, how do I build an amazing course, right? So I think there is something there where I think what a lot of people start with is, how do I market this thing? How do I sell this thing? Early on, before I started teaching the course, by the way, I had no idea what teaching an online live cohort-based course is like. I partnered with the folks at Maven, and I talked to the founders at Maven, who were incredibly gracious in sharing their perspective. In those early conversations, my main questions to them were just about, okay, so how do I make this great? Right? Tell me, I want to learn how to make this great. That was the focus, right? Not the marketing. Right? And I do think there, one mistake that many people make is they kind of put the cart before the horse, and they're fixated on the marketing. I will tell you that most courses can be significantly improved. In fact, even after 9 cohorts, when I get together with my course team to plan the next cohort, the core thing we discuss is, what are we going to improve in the next cohort, right? And what are we going to add What are some creative new things that we're going to add and experiment with this time? And what are some things we are going to drop? I'm not talking about content. I'm talking about the creating that experience of the course in addition to content. Obviously, content is always under work and in progress. But just like from an experience perspective, what are we going to create? So I do think that there is something there. And one last kind of thought I'll share on this topic of teaching a course and doing it in a way that really resonates with students and meaningfully improves their lives is I go back to that kind of George Bernard Shaw quote of like those who can do and those who cannot teach, right? And I think he wrote this in 1903 and perhaps it was true or it has been true. But I'll tell you, it is not true in this internet era. And here's why. Here's why. I do think that the best teachers will be also the best practitioners. So if you cannot do the thing, right, or you haven't been able to do the thing, or if you've had average degree of success with said thing, odds are extremely high that in the internet era, you are going to struggle, right? Now, you might still succeed, but you'll be more that exception, than the rule. And there is a reason why, there is a logical reason why this is the case. And the reason is that, if you take the average product manager or the average software engineer in almost any part of the world, like when I say average, I mean the median. Let's take the median product manager or the median software engineer in almost any part of the world, they make a very decent income, luckily, right? But if you take the median online instructor, okay, the median online instructor, or if you take the median newsletter writer, that person will make nearly $0. And that's because when you're teaching online, there are no physical constraints, right? So naturally, students will gravitate to the best two or three teachers out there in any niche, right? So even in a niche, students are going to gravitate towards the best two or three teachers out there, right? And those teachers, those instructors will make very good revenue, right? But because with the internet, there are no physical boundaries, right? Like the rest are going to struggle to sell seats for their online course. Right. So you see, students are not stupid, right? They can tell whether an instructor is actually great at their craft and really knows their stuff. Right. And again, they're going to gravitate towards, instructors who are great at their craft. They know their stuff. They've done this before. They're not merely teaching with some academic understanding of this thing. Right. So I think it's important to like really recognize that, if one is kind of aspiring to be a teacher or an online creator, et cetera, et cetera. Looking back, one thing I've found useful as one is kind of thinking about this, which is like, okay, so how do I build a great course? Like my recommendation is build your course like you build a product, right? Build like, and for particularly for product people, you already know how to, hopefully, you already know how to build a great product. Well, a course is no different, right? Think of it like an experience that your students are going through, right? And as a teacher, you are responsible for crafting that experience, right? Think intently about how you want them to be ready to learn. At what points in your instruction do you especially want them to pay attention? And what are some hooks that you're going to create so that they pay attention? Right? How will you engineer moments that build confidence in your students at the right time? How will you engineer moments where perhaps you create some internal conflict and really get students to question their pre-existing programming? Right? So there is a lot of art to kind of building a course. And again, the kind of core principle to follow is build your course like you would build any product, and try to make it successful that way.
So, and I think it's really interesting that the deliberate approach you took to creating it in the first place as well, where you just got, like, some people might just be like, you know, hey, creating courses seems to be like a thing now, and people are doing that, and, you know, I can make some money, so maybe I'll go do that. But yours was very, your sort of like origin of it was very organic, from basically asking, you know, how can I bring leverage to my coaching, and how can I bring personalization to my writing, and sort of meet in the middle of these two poles, and hopefully deliver something that's maybe even more valuable, you know, to more people and in a deeper way than either of those things are able to do. So it's a really interesting origin story, and sounds like it's worked out extremely well. I know that you sort of have a contrarian view as well on writing content and, you know, building an audience and an online following. And it's easy to, like, go on Twitter and you see these people with thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers, and you think, oh, I got to go, you know, build an audience of my own. And there's certainly a lot of value in that. But I think you're of the perspective that, you know, I think even a few years ago, you didn't really have a huge online following, and yet you were just as successful of a PM as, you know, you were, you know, a year after you started the following and everything like that. So it doesn't take away from your ability to do great work and sort of build more of a private network. But maybe you could share a little bit about your thoughts on writing content and sharing that publicly and building an online following, and how people can kind of determine, you know, whether that's something they should be doing or that they want to be doing, or when the right time is to kind of get started on that journey.
Yeah. And the core principle for that is, first, be excellent. So if you're going to write about whatever topic, like, say in my case, product management, right? Like, and building products and leading teams and whatnot, you know, be excellent at it. Because when you are excellent at it, it shows in your writing. It just shows, right? And when you're not, the interesting part is that while you might get some engagement, because, you know, volume is easy, right? But I will observe that the really savvy people, right, the people who are the best in the business, the people who are in the, you know, sort of positions of influence, and the people you really actually want to kind of notice you, those folks are very savvy. And they can tell. They can tell just from your writing that, yeah, you may have written some things, but you don't truly understand the things you've written about, right? Or you haven't actually gone through the experience of what you've written about. So I do think that people sometimes kind of end up thinking, oh, writing online is going to be positive for my career. And then, yes, maybe you can amass, you know, 1,000 followers, tens of thousands of followers, or even more than 100,000 followers. But it's not the volume that matters. It's the quality of your followership that, like, actually first matters. If you are doing this to further your career, right? And that's a big if. So, you know, folks come to me and ask me sometimes, like, oh, so, you know, as part of kind of thinking about my career and furthering my career, how important is my online brand and my online followership? And so I'll share with you what I share in those types of conversations, which is, first, I would say that if this is your passion, if you absolutely love it, right, which is writing online or posting content online, if it fills your life with joy, just do it, right? No need to ask me, you know, just do it. Because joy is important. And if you derive joy from it, just do it. Now, I'll tell you, this doesn't apply to most people. Most people are typically, you know, feeling guilty that they don't post online enough, or they're not really investing in their online brand. And they feel a sense of resistance, and they wonder to themselves, like, wait, should I overcome this resistance? right? So if somebody falls in kind of that category, then what I'll first ask them and like have them evaluate is, are you top 10% in your craft, in your work? Top 10%, top 5%, whatever, right? Like, are you really great? Right? And if you are, say you are a top 5% product manager, or say you are a top 5% engineering manager, then I will beseech you to please write online or put out content online. Right? Because we need that. I will follow you, right? I will learn from you, right? And I want others to learn from you. I want the industry at large to learn from you. But let's say that is not the case, right? So where we are in the decision tree is like, this is not something that you derive massive amounts of personal joy from. And second, you are not yet a top 5%, top 10% person in your field. Okay. Now, if you want to think about it rationally, it's a question of opportunity cost. Right? Because any choice we make precludes a different choice we could have made because your time is finite. Right? So sometimes people make the logical error of seeing somebody's Twitter thread about how writing online opened all sorts of doors for them and got them interviews or whatever else, right? Like, so like concrete doors, not meaning like actual open doors that otherwise wouldn't have been opened. Not just like some famous person followed them or whatever. But this was actually positive for my career in XYZ ways, right? And great, like it's great that writing online was positive in XYZ ways. You got this interview, et cetera, et cetera. Or this founder reached out to you and whatnot. But the real question is, at what cost did this happen, right? Where else could you have invested your time, perhaps for an even better return, right? So again, if we've established that you're not yet top five, top 10% in your craft, how might you have been better off if you actually invested that time in actually building competence and doing actual side projects like building products or other things, right? Improving your product sense or improving your influence skills or whatever else. And I think people sometimes underestimate like just how much they can grow their competence. And so to me, that kind of last part is about opportunity cost. Yeah, sure, you can post online and amass, thousands, tens of thousands of followers. And sure, you can show me some case where you got an interview. Let's say actually take it further than that, right? Which is like, let's say you're looking for a job and you have a decent online following, et cetera. And now you got a few interview calls because of that. Let's say that there is a company that kind of hired you in part because they were impressed with your online writing and your online followership. Right, like, or the number of you have 50,000 followers. So they were, at least in part, it's not the only reason, but at least in part, they were influenced by that. You like ask yourself, like, is it a good thing that that happened? Right, because a company that actually hires somebody, again, factors in their online following into the hiring decision, is a company that will likely make other such errors in hiring. They're not just going to do this for you. They're going to make other such errors in hiring for other roles, right? And so is this, especially if it's a startup, is this startup likely to succeed? Right? Because if you're a startup particularly, you should be hiring based on competence and ability, right? In the actual job. So I do suggest that people really think hard about this opportunity cost. And the last thing I'll share here is that sometimes, somebody will say, but Shez, what about you? Like, you're not being consistent because, like, you have a very large following. And so what's going on with that? But the reality is that I did not, for 95% of my product career, I did not have a large following. I was focused on doing the job and making product successful and making team successful. And in my spare time, again, thinking about opportunity cost, I was more focused on, certainly I was on Twitter since 2007. I loved Twitter since 2007, but I was more focused on consuming and learning. Right. There were some times when I came out of my cave and kind of posted some content. So there was a time in 2010 when I did a talk, and then there was another time in 2018 when I did another talk, right? And posted some kind of net new content in the field. But it was only in 2020 after COVID started and I had like a spare couple of hours that I actually started writing. In fact, had COVID not happened, I wouldn't have started writing until much later. So I think again, people don't quite understand like the order of things, right? Perhaps the reason why my writing resonated as soon as I started writing in 2020 is because I had had that experience and I'd worked on building that competence. So those would be some ways in which you can kind of logically think through this decision for yourself.
Yeah, I would even add to the first part of what you said. This is, my perspective, maybe or maybe not yours, but to the point about like doing it, if it gives you joy, and if you enjoy doing it, then just go for it. Because at the end of the day, that's sort of important enough, and there will probably be other benefits from it. But if you just enjoy it, then just do it. A thing that I would add on that, like an angle I would add, in my own experience at least, is that also it doesn't need to be even so black and white. It can be do it in the way that you enjoy it. So some people might go and post content that they feel like is the right content that they should be posting or something like that, and maybe that's not enjoyable for them. But if they were doing it in another way, if they were posting a different type of content, maybe that would be an enjoyable. And for me, certainly that's been a large factor in sort of the way that I've chosen to do the podcast, where I focus on the pieces of it that I would do even if there was never going to be a bigger audience or anything like that, or even if there was really no sort of return on it. It's the parts that I enjoy doing that I continue to do. And if over time that builds a large audience, then that's great. And if it doesn't, that was never sort of an implicit part of my agreement from the get-go. I'm just kind of doing what I like to do in terms of content creation. What I don't like to do is like sort of spend a bunch of time creating custom thumbnails and, all, like creating a Twitter thread based on a blog post that I wrote, because I just like writing the blog post. Like, I don't really like making it, bite-sized or whatever else it might be. And so for some people, the answer to whether or not you enjoy creating content may be somewhat nuanced, and it might be like, well, this type I enjoy and this type I don't. And if you can focus on the part that you enjoy and everything else from what you just said sort of applies, then I think that's, a great reason to go forward. And you can sort of gradually work into it, which it sounds like is sort of what you've done over the years, where you started, you kind of dabbled, you were mostly on Twitter kind of consuming, but occasionally you would do something. And then over time, you're like, okay, I'm ready. And it's time to really post a lot of this stuff that I'm writing and everything like that. So I think it can be, it is very much a matter of timing, like you said. And I think, yeah, it's just something that I keep in mind in terms of my content approach from the early days. So I know we're coming up on time soon, but would love to go through a few concepts that I've learned from you through your sharing of content over the years. And I think they're just really interesting concepts that I haven't really heard you speak about too much else elsewhere. The first one would be the curse of brilliance. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the curse of brilliance is the observation that when somebody highly successful and prolific is analyzing or sharing what makes them successful and prolific, they unwittingly tend to overemphasize the things that they found very difficult. And they underemphasize, they underplay, or altogether ignore the importance of things at which they were naturally brilliant. Okay, so and I'll share a couple of examples to kind of make this concrete because I think as we were talking about content and consuming content, I do think that it is very essential in this age of exponentially growing content that we become more critical thinkers about the content and what it means and what content to apply and what content to perhaps take with a grain of salt, even if that content is coming from somebody who's otherwise extremely successful at whatever it is that they did, right? So, like, you know, and the way I kind of discovered this idea of the curse of brilliance is, you know, is this quote that gets shared often online. And if you share it on Twitter, you're guaranteed to get a lot of likes, which is, it goes something like, when art critics get together, they talk about form and structure and meaning. But when artists get together, they talk about where you can buy cheap turpentine. Okay, so this is like one quote that kind of tends to get shared. And you know, apparently this quote is attributed to Picasso. And the point is, like, you know, people hear this, they get impressed, and they conclude that if you want to be great at something, if you want to be Picasso, you should ignore all the abstract stuff, which is like form, structure, and meaning, whatever it is. You should ignore all that abstract crap, and you should just focus on the tactics that the great ones employ, right? The tactics being, you know, hey, where can I get cheap turpentine, right? And in the business world, it's like, hey, what's the process for getting this done, right? Or like, you know, help me understand this tactic, right? Give me tactics, give me things that I can use tomorrow, right? Whatever it might be. So that's like one quote. The other one that had bugged me for a while is this whole, again, this gets a lot of likes, which is amateur stock strategy and professional stock logistics, right? And so the idea being that, like, well, if you want to be a true professional, you should fixate on logistics and operations, right? And it's all those McKinsey types that just like don't actually do much that talk strategy, and they are amateurs, right? And so my observation is that these kinds of conclusions are just basically flawed and harmful. Okay. And so, you know, getting into the reason why, right? Like, okay, so why do, say, when great artists get together, why do you think they talk about where you can buy cheap turpentine? And why do you think they skip over all the, you know, abstract stuff, right? Like whatever that ends up being, form, structure, meaning, right? According to that quote. Well, the real reason is that these are gifted artists. They have a gift or gifts that very few human beings ever born possess. And yet, because they're artists, they tend to be poor. And so, therefore, they talk about cheap turpentine. They don't need to discuss the form and structure and meaning because they just get it. They're gifted with that. Right? And it's similar with the professionals talking about logistics, because real professionals, they have a deep strategic sense, which is why they even reached a stage where you would call them up on stage and have them speak to you. Right? So what happens to people when they're asked? Now, this is a poor question to ask, but it still gets asked all the time, which is, okay, so what is the reason for your success? Right? So you ask somebody incredibly prolific, a billionaire founder, right? Like, ooh, like what were the ingredients for your success? Again, very poor question, but it tends to get asked all the time in interviews. Well, here's the reality, right? Number one, say if it's like a billionaire visionary founder who's asked this question, right? Oftentimes, until they are like old enough and mature enough, people don't even understand their innate gifts that cause them to have that like extreme outlier success. Right? Because in order to reach there, this person would have had to have, like, and especially if they've done it consistently, it's not a fluke, they would have had to have exceptional intuition and instinct and creativity inside. Right? And such a brilliant visionary founder, they can see something that nobody else can see. They saw something that nobody else saw. Such a brilliant visionary person, right? They take these kind of gifts for granted. Like they kind of don't even know that they exist because they think everybody operates that way. Right? So that's one reason. And so what they often will end up sharing are the things that were tough for them. Right? So they will talk about the grind, right? Like, and they'll talk about the operations as they were scaling the business, right? And so they will talk about the grit, right? They'll talk about the determination, et cetera, et cetera. And granted, like all of those things are very vital, right? But we kind of confuse necessary and sufficient conditions, right? So that's one thing. The other reason why people end up overemphasizing these things, like, they'll say luck, they'll say grit, they'll say, like building a great culture, they'll say, building an awesome execution machine or running operations, right? Like these will be the responses of like lessons learned or what like enabled your success or what have you. There's another reason why all of these things are being said, right? Especially the luck thing. Right? Because it is the popular answer to provide. Right? Because, like, look, if somebody asked you, like, hey, what makes you so amazing at XYZ? And if you said, well, it was my creativity. Right? Or it's my cognitive empathy. Or it's some like skill, core skill. In most parts of the world, it's not going to be a popular answer. Right? But if instead, if you just say, oh, it was luck, like I consider myself really lucky, right? That gives other people hope. That gives the audience hope. Right? Because if you say creativity, which is actually the truth, right? But if you say that, it's not going to be the popular answer. So understand that whether it's unintentional or intentional, this curse of brilliance strikes in many, many situations and in a lot of pieces of content that get shared, right? And one last thing I'll share here, and this is very unfortunate. We live in sort of most, places around the world. We don't talk openly about what we are great at, even if we understand it. And we are doing a disservice to others. Because if people don't understand what the real ingredients of being great at this craft are, and if we keep saying, well, it's grit and it's like, just working day in and day out on your operations, or it's luck, right? You're kind of misguiding them. Sure, they love to hear it, but it's not actually helping anybody. If anything, it's hurting, right? So as you evaluate, as you review content online along these lines, I want you to understand the curse of brilliance.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating perspective. I totally understand, when people are asked what made them successful, resonates strongly that the answers are very much what you said they are. It's people will say, well, I got really lucky, or I was very fortunate to have these people around, or whatever it might have been, because the alternative sounds basically arrogant or something like that. But I agree with you completely. It's a disservice. to those who actually want to know, if for no other reason to determine, do I have what it takes basically to do that thing that this person did? And if it's just a matter of luck, then maybe I can get just as lucky as the next guy. But if it's a matter of having some core competency or brilliance that I just don't have, that's an extremely useful answer to receive, because the opportunity cost of not having that answer is basically spending your entire life gunning in a direction that you really just don't have the chops for. When people respond to that question with luck, you know, at the very least, I'm always interested in kind of the follow-up question of, well, how did you get lucky? You know, was it, usually they're not talking about, hey, you know, I was born in, you know, California around the time of, you know, the internet or something, which is, you know, that's more of a form of blind luck. And there is a real element of, you know, luck there. But a lot of what people sort of categorize under the header of luck is actually opportunities that they generated for themselves, possibly from that, you know, brilliance that they have, or some, you know, very specific sort of decisions that they made of, you know, how to, what to do with their life and, you know, how to do that and whatever it might have been, how to apply what they're best at in their life. So that's, it's a really interesting concept, and I know I'll certainly keep it in mind.
On that topic of luck particularly, when somebody says luck, in a way, technically they're not wrong, but they're wrong in the way that they frame it. So most people, when they say luck, then they will cite, and then interviewer asks, tell me more. And so they cite events. Right. Oh, well, this happened and I was in this building at this time. And then, you know, this person observed me and then they funded me, or this person promoted me, whatever the case may be. They cite events, right? Even take the example of like, well, you know, like I was lucky because I was born in California during the 80s or 70s or 60s or whatever, right? And I was born in Silicon Valley, whatever the case might be. That is an event. Well, guess what? Millions of babies were born, you know, in that circumstance, right? So why did this happen with you and not with the other million babies, right? The actual answer is luck, but not in the way that it's expressed or understood. The real answer is the innate talents and abilities, and particularly superpowers, right? You did not choose them. Really, you did not choose them. You know, for world-class levels, I'm talking about world-class, everybody can improve their creativity, just like everybody can improve their jump shot in basketball. But not everybody can be Steph Curry. I don't care how much you practice, right? So I think it's important to understand that, like, when they are saying luck, they're right, but not in the way they say it is, right? It's just that they were lucky enough to be blessed or born with the right ingredients. And, you know, in terms of events, perhaps they were lucky enough that the environment did not screw it up. Right. And as long as the environment does not screw it up, these people are going to do fine. Right. Because they'll find their path. So like, even this topic of luck is so nuanced, and most people don't think about it that way. They just take the, oh, this event occurred in my life, and therefore, you know, it led to this grand success.
Right. And well, once you know as well, once you understand that underlying version of the luck answer, that's actually true, I think you can go and you can ask yourself the more important question of, to your point, you know, okay, I might not be able to, no matter how hard I practice, I won't be able to shoot like Steph Curry, but in what area do you have Steph Curry potential? And then, you know, to your point, there is a large luck component to that. Some people, you're sort of born, I think it sounds like you agree with this, which, you know, would be my perspective as well, which is that you're sort of born with some, you know, I personally think everyone is born with tremendous potential. But what that potential looks like is very different. It's not just like one, you know, line of potential. It's all these different potentials in all these different areas. And To be able to identify, to ask yourself that question, be able to identify along what lines do I have that Steph Curry potential, then can guide where you spend time in your life getting better at the things where your ceiling is, top percentile or top 0.0001 percentile in the world. And so it becomes actually an extremely valuable question to ask yourself once you can sort of dig a few layers into the nuance. Another concept that I've come across from yours is this concept of using stack rank. And so could you talk a little bit about sort of how that's been useful for you in career and in life?
So I've observed that when whether this is in kind of life and personal situations or in business situations, when we start talking about something, whatever the topic might be, we tend to attach a higher degree of importance to said thing than it actually warrants. Right. And so I started observing this a few years ago, and then I came across the focusing illusion, which was, I believe, kind of shared and popularized by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. And it basically says nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you're thinking about it. And when I saw that, I said, yes, this explains a lot of what I've seen in product work, even when we are deciding. So, hey, should we build X? And here's how it manifests, right? Like, somebody comes in, maybe it's the sales team, and says, like, very important customer has asked for X feature, whatever X is. And so then now we start discussing X and how we might implement it and how many resources it'll require and like how we might get those resources because we have something else to do and whether it's even a good idea to do X, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And in almost every such interaction, what we kind of fixate on is just this idea of X, right? And we don't think about the other options. Okay. And so that leads to highly unproductive conversations and slower decision making, and bad decision making, right? And so I'll perhaps share an example of where this idea of stack rank came in as a solution to this problem, right? And I'll share two examples actually from my experience at Stripe. So the first one was that at Stripe, when I would talk to customers, they would talk a lot about a certain feature being really important for them. So oftentimes I would also see like PMs and engineers and others kind of like then taking that feedback and then sharing it with say the executive team that like oh we are really hearing that X is very important for customers, right? And so I started noticing that sometimes then that proposal would get green lighted, and now we build that feature X, and it turns out nobody's using it, right? And you go back to the people who said that they would use X and say, hey, now this thing, remember you asked about this, now this thing is available. And this happened to me too. You go back and you ask them, you tell them, this thing you asked for is available now. So go ahead and use it. And they say, oh, yes, thank you. Thank you for building this. You're the best. And we are going to use this. But right now we have some operational challenges or some other challenges. And so we have prioritized this for the next quarter. Okay, so you say, great, let's talk next quarter. So you go back to them the next quarter. And it's the same story, which is, oh, yes, we still have intent to use this thing, but we have some other problem that we are dealing with, and that's a higher priority. And so therefore, we are going to focus our efforts there. But don't worry, like this feature is something we really need, and we hope to use it. And you kind of like, and this story should sound familiar to people, who, especially for people who build B2B products, business to business products. And so as I personally experienced this, and I saw many product people, many otherwise smart product people experience this, I started asking myself, why is this happening? And that's when I realized that, like, actually, you know, when, again, it's the focusing illusion, which is when you ask a customer or when a customer tells you about a certain problem, you are focused on that problem at the exclusion of all the other problems that the customer is facing. And when you focus on that problem, again, according to the focusing illusion, it will seem important than it truly is. Right? So then I started thinking, okay, so what's the solution to this? How do I make better and more rigorous product decisions? Because I know I cannot change every single customer. Customers are going to say what they say, right? So how do I figure that out? So that's when I kind of stumbled across this simple but profoundly powerful tool of stack ranking, right? Which is in roughly the way it would work in this situation, is at the end of this conversation about this problem X, you say, thank you for sharing this. And what I'd like to understand is, we've talked a lot about this problem, particular problem, and I have a lot of information now and a lot of context on it. But what I'd like to do now, and you can even do it on the follow-up conversation, what I'd like to do is to be able to have some sort of stack rank of the problems that you or your org are currently facing. Right. So could you first describe those other problems to me? Right. And once they describe the other problems, then you ask them to stack rank them, like which is the highest importance, which is the highest priority? What is the most burning issue? What is the next? What is the next? And what is the next after that? Right. So that's kind of like how you kind of, you know, stack rank. And so I call this the customer problem stack rank, CPSR. Right. And what happens when you actually force that conversation is you might realize that this thing, this feature X that, you know, you spend a ton of time talking about, it's actually not even their number one or number two or number three priority. It is a priority, but it's not the number one, number two priority. And practically what happens for most businesses is that they barely get a chance to work on their first or second or third priority in any given quarter. Right. So while everybody was being honest and earnest in this conversation, like without this stack ranking, it is extremely difficult to identify whether it's a smart call to build this or not. Right. And I mentioned this at the level of a feature, but I also have observed there are so many B2B and SaaS startups that are basically destined to fail, regardless of how well they execute, they're destined to fail. Because they start off addressing a problem which is never going to be among the top 3, 4, 5, 6 concerns for significant number of businesses. So then what chance do you have? Like, you can build a beautiful product and you can do everything right in your execution, but if you haven't really stack ranked the customer's actual problems, it's not going to work. Right. So that was one example of, like, you know, and this was obviously over a period of like a couple of years where I kind of then discovered the power of a stack rank. I'll share one other example that's more related to prioritization, you know, and an ongoing prioritization, which is, and this wasn't initiated by me. This was, you know, we had somebody who was an engineering leader at Stripe, you know, in around 2016 or so. And they observed that, you know, there's just too much for us to do. And so they proposed, like, basically a simple tool, which I thought was brilliant, was this ongoing stack rank, right? OSR, it used to be called. And essentially what it was like, at a certain level, say at the level of like the company or whatever, what is the stack rank of projects, right? What is the most important and what is the least important? The reason this was powerful is that without this, any new thing that came in used to be discussed in isolation. And then it was a painful conversation and it was never clear like what the right answer is, and you'd have meetings upon meetings sometimes and you're still not sure, right? Or you might end up overcommitting yourself by just saying yes to it, right? Now with this OSR tool, the ongoing stack rank, when a new thing comes in, like a new request comes in, you say, okay, it might be reasonable and to address this request and implement this, but where would you put it in the stack rank, right? So you explicitly, by using this OSR tool, by using the stack rank as a construct, you're explicitly kind of like preventing falling prey to the focusing illusion, right? Because you do have to discuss this specific feature or this specific request or issue in the context of everything else. And so oftentimes, you know, most human beings, they're binary thinkers. And so we just like are talking about, is this important or is this not important? But the real question is, we got to evaluate how important is this in the context of everything else that's going on. And it's not just about, will we get positive ROI from working on this? It's more about what is the thing that, you know, minimizes our opportunity cost. So again, the stack rank ends up being a very useful tool for that. So those are some couple of examples, but really the stack rank applies to many things, including even career decisions and life decisions.
Yeah, it's a great framework for determining the relative importance of things. And I think I didn't realize that it came from this, that the driver, that the problem that the stack ranking solution solves for was driven from this like sort of focus illusion. And yeah, it's just a powerful way to sort of get past that very human bias, I feel like, and to actually ask yourself, okay, we've spent an hour talking about this, but you know, that's actually not even in our top list of priorities. We just, the context of the conversation led us down this path. So obviously we could talk about it for a while, but it can be, you know, very misleading, and a company can exist solely to solve this problem that doesn't actually even, it does exist, but it doesn't, it just doesn't make the priority list. So before you go and go heads down for days or months or years on a particular thing, whether that's as a company or even personally, I think really understanding why you're attacking that thing versus any number of other things and going through the stack rank exercise saves a ton of time in the long run. So I know, I know we're coming up, well, we're actually over on time, but if there's one more concept we can discuss, it's this power of simulation concept that you've also coined. So maybe we can finish with that. And it's been an awesome conversation, and yeah, curious to go on to this one last concept.
Yeah, for sure. So simulation as an activity is I think a key part of product thinking, and product thinking applies to many endeavors of business and life, not just when you're building products. Really the best way I can kind of describe it for folks is, if you've watched Avengers Infinity War, in that movie, there is a point at which Doctor Strange is, he basically tries to simulate, future possibilities of how the Avengers and humanity's war against Thanos, who wants to basically kill half of all the living beings in the universe, how might it end? Right. So what Doctor Strange does at that moment in the movie is he goes into this kind of almost trance like state, and his friends, including, Iron Man and others, are confused about what Doctor Strange is doing. And so once he's out of that trance, they ask him. And so what he said is, what Doctor Strange says is, I looked into the future. He has the time stone, so he can do that. I looked into the future and looked at, 14,605 possible futures of how this conflict will end. And so then, his friends naturally ask him, like, okay, and how many did we win in, right? Did we win versus Thanos? And he answers one. One out of those 14,605,000 possible futures, right? So that is, it sounds like it's a good scene. You should watch it if you haven't recently. But that thing that Doctor Strange did, right? It doesn't require any sorcery, and it doesn't require the time stone, right? We are all capable of doing this, perhaps to different degrees, but we are all capable of doing this, but we don't do it often enough, right? So what ends up happening in certainly in life and in business, right, in many, many business meetings, is that people and teams, they look backward, right? Like, and they look at the present. They have a bunch of data, they have a bunch of context, they have a bunch of research, bunch of information. And then based on all of that, they make a rational decision of what to do. And then they say, okay, now we're going to go ahead and do it. What I've observed is that in this process, many times people skip the step of looking forward and simulating the possible futures, right? And the reality is you're making changes to a system when you make a decision. Right, and the system will often involve people. And so you need to ask yourself, like, as you are making this decision, what is going to happen? What are the different possibilities? Right? And even like even when people are involved, you cannot think of people, many people make the mistake of thinking of people as one monolithic entity, which is users. How will customers react? Not only that, they make the mistake of assuming that the customer is like them. Right. Sometimes, like I've worked, been fortunate to work with incredibly smart engineers, and not all engineers, but like what I'm about to say correlates with some smart engineers, is that many of them assume that every user would react like them. Right. Which is like, well, clearly this is the most logical thing to do. So everybody will be logical. Right. But that's not how the world works. Right, so you cannot look at like even users or customers and people as one monolithic entity, right? You have to think about different segments of users, right? Like segments of customers. Maybe your large customers will react differently from your small customers when you make this blog post announcing this policy change, right? Each segment might have different concerns. Not only that, but if you're a large company, you'll have ex other external stakeholders, not just customers and users. You'll have the press, you'll have regulators, you'll have social media. Right. So lack of simulation or not giving enough importance to simulation is why companies often make suboptimal decisions, and sometimes they make decisions that then they have to backtrack on. Right. Because they didn't really like spend time thinking through how this will work. Right. To give you a more recent example, like the whole, issue with the OpenAI board firing Sam Altman, right? Like, and putting out that message, right? Like, who knows what actually happened, but at least it is fair to say that not enough time was given to simulation. Because if you had simulated, like, how this might play out, like, these are all incredibly smart and intelligent people. Right, then you would perhaps have avoided this issue, or at least you could have done better messaging around how you would approach it, right? Now, one last thing I'll say about this is often people claim that, like, all this sounds great, but like, we want to move fast. And so we can't, like, really slow down and do simulation, Shreyas. Right. But here's the thing. What you need to understand is that if you build the skill of simulation, which you can only build through practice, but the people who have these skills, and I know many dozens of people who like are like basically really amazing at this skill. Once you kind of learn the skill and once you kind of become an expert, actual process of doing this takes only seconds or minutes. in most cases. And in the most difficult cases, in the most complex cases, it takes at most hours. So I don't care how fast you want to move. You can take a few extra seconds, minutes, or just a couple of hours. Okay? And the great thing about simulation is it works at the macro scale. Like it even works at the scale of major government policy decisions, as an example. So that's like fairly macro, but it also works at a very micro scale, right? So like one thing I did for many, many years is like in the morning before I start doing my work, I would look through the meetings that I have for the day and I would actually simulate those meetings. Like what is going to occur? Like what is the other party going to say? Et cetera, et cetera, right? Like, and it took only like 5 minutes to simulate through 5-6 meetings that I had, but it helped me prepare for those meetings much better, right? Another example I'll share is like at some point, when I was at Stripe, I was asked to put together an offsite for an important strategic topic with, a small group of 10 to 12 people. It included the founders and a few other kind of like, product folks and engineers and so on. And so I was responsible for putting the offsite together. I wanted to kind of be thoughtful about the offsite because a lot of offsites kind of, you talk a bunch of stuff, but like they don't really go anywhere, right? So I didn't want that to occur with this offsite. So what I did is actually simulated many possible outcomes and, okay, what if I change this variable? How might that work in the simulation? Right. And then so based on, simulation, I designed the offsite in a very unique way. It was a half a day offsite. And after the half a day of the offsite, a lot of people came to me proactively and said, you know what, something about this offsite, it's the best offsite I've been at. And I've been at like many, many offsites. In large part, actually, the reason it worked as well is because I had simulated many different kind of alternatives and options and possible futures, and I'd eliminated the ones that would not have an optimal effect. And so that's kind of how I ended up doing it. So it's a very, very powerful tool. The only way that you can even use the tool is first you recognize the importance of doing it, and second, you commit to practicing it because that's the only way to get good at it.
Yeah, it's a super interesting concept, and I think I didn't really have a name for it, and the simulation I think is a great shorthand just to give it a name of sort of thinking ahead and how will different people feel about this thing that this action that I'm about to take or whatever it might be. But I think it's something that whether I had a name for it or not, I personally do. I'm probably like kind of over indexed on it in a sense where I like do it a lot. It does make decisions more conscious in a way where you're not just kind of doing, you're playing out all the different outcomes. And then a lot of people just kind of don't really do that very naturally. And to your point, I think even, whether one could do it too much is maybe a different question, but you don't have to be like Doctor Strange with the time stone and play out these futures and know exactly what all 14 million are going to look like. But if you just kind of do the 80-20 version, like you said, you take a few minutes and you do your best to think forward as to how these various things will play out, like the OpenAI board. You just take a few minutes and you think like, well, Sam Altman's actually pretty popular and our company's actually like pretty well regarded by the public right now, and throwing a big fork in it might not be received super well, so we might need to sort of proceed with caution here. Like you spend a few minutes, it doesn't take much time. And sure, if you spent days simulating things forward and maybe writing out all of the different outcomes you could imagine, that might be overall a net better exercise. But I imagine that most of the value comes sort of in the first few seconds or minutes or hours, and so if you just kind of do a little bit, that can go a long way probably. And one way I'll just sort of maybe end with this on my end. One way I think that I apply that personally, like a very simple, super quick one, is for actually like big decisions in life. I love to refer to or remind myself of this concept I learned from Jeff Bezos, which is the regret minimization framework. So he basically, for these like big life decisions, he talks about this when he decided to start Amazon and leave a hedge fund. He sort of projected himself to like age 80 or 90 or whatever on his deathbed. And he's like, well, if I look back from that point in time, which one of these decisions am I more likely to regret? Like going and trying to be a part of this internet thing, or, not continuing on with the hedge fund? And when you project forward and you sort of simulate, to use the word, and sort of imagine these future scenarios of, well, in one case you stayed at the hedge fund, and in another case you went and tried this thing, and you don't know, you can't predict the future, so you don't know if the thing's going to fail or if it's going to succeed. But in general, you can kind of put yourself in your deathbed and at least do your best to kind of look back on what that was. And if you do that, I think a lot of times it makes the right decision a lot more clear than if you just kind of operate based on, what you know from the past and what you're feeling in the moment and things like that. So anyway, a bunch of ways in which that resonates with me. Those are just a couple, but
Another tool that is similar to this regret minimization framework, but you can apply it on your day-to-day projects, as particularly your really important projects and launches and whatnot, is the idea of a pre-mortem. And we can put in the show notes. I have a whole kind of ritual and recipe around how to perform a good pre-mortem. But basically the idea being that you sit down say 3 months before a very important product launch as a team, and you kind of state that, like, let's imagine we are 3 months into the future and our project launch has failed. So let's make that assumption. Now let's figure out and let's list out the reasons why that may have happened. Right. And it's a really powerful tool. It doesn't take that much time, and it can help avoid a lot of, like, really obvious mistakes that many companies end up making. And so it's basically a group simulation exercise, the pre-mortem is. Particularly, the great thing about a pre-mortem is it enables and creates, by definition, the psychological safety for people to kind of think a little pessimistically, right? So again, you can kind of largely be an optimist, but it actually helps to, take a small percentage of your time and apply, look through at the pessimism lens. And so the pre-mortem is that kind of, it creates that pessimism lens, and it helps people be more vocal about concerns that they've had, in a way that they don't feel like they'll be ostracized from the group. So it's a really powerful exercise. I do it for almost every meaningful project that I embark on, including, my course. I've done the pre-mortem a couple of times actually, for the course. So it can be used in all sorts of projects. It doesn't just have to be a product launch. And so I highly, highly recommend that.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. Well, I know we've gone way over on time, so I appreciate you taking the time and sticking with me and sharing all of these insights. I think I know you built your career in product management, but you're very evidently an extremely eloquent speaker, and I think a great teacher and coach. So I appreciate you taking the time, and hopefully this is a way to kind of find that in between on coaching people one-on-one and writing to the masses and finding that in between where it is hopefully specifically relevant to a lot of people who listen. So looking forward to getting it out there. But just in closing, anywhere where best place for people to go and to follow you on Twitter or sign up for the course, anywhere you want to send people in particular?
Yeah, I would just say find me on Twitter and on LinkedIn or on YouTube. And that's really the best way to follow my content and learn more about these things and various other things. So, yeah, that's the best place to start.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Shreyas. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was really fun.